Hello, and welcome to History Rage, where we invite historians to blow the whistle and then charge relentlessly into the truth. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and I'm manning this lonely dugout alone today as we're recording during the day to accommodate the time difference with today's guest. And today's guest for this week, we are joined by Professor of African and African American Studies at Brandeis University and author of Wounded World, W.E.B. Du Bois and the First World War. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Professor Chad Williams. Chad, welcome to History Rage.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Feeling angry?
A little bit. My juices are flowing.
Good.
We'll see how it goes.
Okay. You've come to us via your publicist at Coriolis, so I'd like to thank you and Nanda for doing my recruitment work for me. But prior to today, our paths haven't crossed at all, so could you give us and everybody out there an insight into you, your background, what's driven you to both write the books you've written and study the field that you study?
Sure. I received my undergraduate education at University of California, Los Angeles, majored in history and African-American studies. Always had a strong passion for history, even as a little kid, being surrounded by books and music and posters in my house. So I like to think that it was kind of seeped into my DNA at a young age. I went to graduate school at Princeton University, where I received my PhD in history. I thought I was going to graduate school to study the Reconstruction and Civil War era, but began to get interested in World War One and thinking about the place of African Americans in World War One. And I still remember the moment, and my interest as well as my rage kind of started building when I realized that there had just been so little about the Black experience in World War One, and specifically the experiences of African American soldiers and veterans. So I wanted to do something about it. That became my dissertation, my first book, Torchbearers of Democracy, African American Soldiers in the World War One Era. And in fact, it was in the process of doing research for that project where I encountered W.E.B. Du Bois and his longstanding interests, commitments, even obsession with World War One. I discovered a manuscript, a book that Du Bois spent 20 years trying to write on the Black experience in the war and ultimately never finished. And no other historian had ever talked about it before. So I was determined to change that. And that's why I wrote my book, The Wounded World, Du Bois and the First World War.
You've got to see a lot of parallels, I imagine, with Civil War and World War One in terms of its style of fighting. Because from everything I've looked at the Civil War, that is an era where actually trench warfare plays a bigger part than you might think.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, the Civil War was the first modern war in American history. Oftentimes it doesn't get looked at that way just because the fighting was so brutal and catastrophic. But yeah, there was the implementation of a lot of the modern tactics of war, including, as you said, trench warfare in the Civil War that get implemented in World War One. And obviously on a much larger scale in the First World War. But I was particularly interested in the experiences of soldiers, of veterans, what they encountered in and outside of the military, but also what they represented in this larger struggle for African-American civil rights and freedom, and definitely making those connections, those parallels with the Civil War and Reconstruction and how the First World War is approached by men like W.E.B. Du Bois.
Okay, so we're going to kick this off then. We'll kick the rage off with a rage question that we ask everybody, which you've hinted at the general theme that we're going to be covering here. So, Chad, would you please tell all our history ragers out there then what you wish everyone would just stop believing, get over, or just deal with?
I just wish people would stop believing that African Americans had no significant role to play in World War One. It just pisses me off to no end that people still continue to believe that World War One was essentially a white man's war, and that African Americans, in particular, on the one hand, didn't play a significant role in the war, but didn't get anything out of it as well. I mean, that's really what drove me to write my first book, and that's what W.E.B. Du Bois himself was trying to do in writing his own book, a book that was ultimately never completed. But he understood really from the start of the war in 1914 that this was going to be a pivotal moment in the history of Black people throughout the entire globe, throughout the entire African diaspora. But when the United States enters the war in April of 1917, especially for African Americans, he saw this moment as being really a watershed, right, in the struggle of African American civil rights and racial equality and freedom more broadly. That's why he advocated for African Americans to support the war, encouraged Black soldiers to enlist, supported the commissioning of Black officers. He truly believed that this was going to be a transformative moment. And in many respects, it was. But at the same time, it was also deeply disillusioning, a failure in many respects. So that's part of the history that I think we have to recognize, and that people, you know, really need to acknowledge that when we talk about the history of World War I, we're doing a disservice to that history if we don't talk about the experiences of African Americans and other peoples of African descent.
Okay, so let's take a broad brush to start off with then. Could you give us an overview of the significant contributions and roles played by African Americans during World War I? What are some of the key ways they participate in the war effort?
So you have approximately 380,000 African American soldiers who served in the United States Army during the war, right? And that's no small number. That was a significant percentage relative to their population of the American fighting and labor forces. The majority of Black troops actually served as laborers because that's how the military, with its racist kind of Jim Crow mentality at the time, saw Black soldiers as serving. But they played a very important role doing all the dirty work of the war, as stevedores, loading and unloading ships, laying railroad tracks, building roads, burying dead bodies, right? All the unglamorous work of the war that oftentimes we don't like to talk about, but that's what Black soldiers were doing. And they literally helped lay the groundwork for the Allied victory, especially as the United States enters the fighting in 1918. At the same time, you have two Black combat divisions. You have a 92nd Division, which serves in the American Expeditionary Forces, an all-Black combat division, which contained Black officers. And you have another division, the 93rd Division, which actually served with the French. And they were some of the most successful combatants in the American Army. They served with distinction. They really made a name for themselves on the battlefield. They received numerous medals of commendation. So they played a very important role in terms of their battlefield contributions to the Allied victory in 1918. But also thinking more broadly, just in terms of domestic impact of the war and how it served as really the groundwork for what we think of today as the modern civil rights movement, how many of the issues and struggles and even individuals during World War I remain active throughout the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And as I said, really laid the groundwork for the civil rights activism in the 1950s and 60s that we're more familiar with.
So if you've got the guys that are doing the dirty work, they're going to be pretty much everywhere. I don't want to single out the two combat battalions, but it is like an unusual setup for considering the Jim Crow times to have those. Yeah. Whereabouts are they serving? What sort of actions do they see?
Are you referring to the two combat divisions?
Two combat divisions. We'll start with those.
Right. So the two combat divisions actually have very markedly different experiences. So the 93rd Division was made up primarily of Black National Guardsmen. And the military, the American military at the time, didn't know what to do with these guys, right? Because they were, you know, National Guardsmen. Some of them, some of the regiments had Black officers. So these are men who volunteered to fight from New York, from Chicago, from Washington, D.C., other places. So the military, they didn't see a place for them in the American Expeditionary Forces. So they quite literally give them to the French. The French, by the spring of 1918, are so desperate for troops, regardless of who they are, what they look like, where they're from. They're like, hey, come on, we need as many fresh bodies as we can. So they welcome these Black soldiers in the 93rd Division into the ranks, and they put them right to use on the battlefield, throw them right into the fray, and they perform exceptionally well, especially the 369th Infantry Regiment, which comes to be known most famously as the Harlem Hellfires. Mm-hmm. They served for 191 consecutive days on the Western Front, don't lose an inch of territory. They're the first American troops to actually cross the Rhine River after the armistice. So they serve exceptionally well, and were lauded by their French commanders as being actually more effective fighters than white American troops that they had to work with. So that's the 93rd Division. The 92nd Division, however, remained embedded in the American Expeditionary Forces and had to deal with all the institutional racism in the American Expeditionary Forces, especially as it related to Black officers and their combat experiences. So when the Meuse-Argonne offensive in September of 1918, Black soldiers are accused of failing on the battlefield, of being incompetent, all these really false and malicious rumors rooted in the racial stereotypes that the Army had of Black soldiers and officers. So they have a very difficult experience, very trying experience. And that's what W.B. Du Bois was trying to do in writing his book. And that's ultimately the story that I try and tell in my book, how he realized that the racism of the American Army, the color line, and how entrenched it remained, needed to be acknowledged in the history of the war. And he wanted to write this history in a way that was 100% truthful as well as unflinchingly honest.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to follow up then with a question of, well, it's a question that's come from one of our Patreon subscribers, Nathan Brown. So hello to you, Nathan. He asks, as a Canadian, the history of our Black First World War Regiment, the No. 2 Construction Battalion, has started to get covered more and more. Do you think it would have been different if US units like the Harlem Hellfighters that you mentioned had stayed attached to the US Army, or would the indifference remain?
I think that if the Harlem Hellfighters and other Black troops who ultimately served with the French military had remained with the United States Army, they would have had a very different experience. They would have had the same type of racist experience that Black soldiers of the 92nd Division had. Again, the military, it's important to keep this in mind,
yeah,
right? The Army was completely segregated. They believed that racial segregation and white supremacy was in the best interest of, quote unquote, military efficiency, right? Of keeping white and Black soldiers segregated, of making sure that Black soldiers remained in positions of subservience to white officers, right? And that infected every aspect of the American Expeditionary Forces, especially in France, right? Because they were concerned what would happen with these Black soldiers in France and interacting with these radical ideas of liberty and fraternity and equality, and interacting with white French women as well, right? What's going to happen when they come back to the United States and forget their place in the racial hierarchy? So I think that it was to the benefit of Black soldiers like the Harlem Hellfighters to not be associated with the American Expeditionary Forces, because they had a much more liberatory experience. They were able to actually prove themselves on the battlefield. They were not subjected to the racist policies and ideas that were so much a part of the American Army.
Do you think that the French desperation helped there? Because if you go back to like what we would call Edwardian period in England, if you go back to that period of France, it isn't exactly a beacon of racial equality itself at the time, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, so there's this idea that France is this, as you said, kind of colorblind beacon of racial equality. And, you know, to put it bluntly, that's bullshit. France had its own race problem. France was very aware of the color line, especially as it related to its colonial policies and relationships with its colonial subjects and its relationship with their colonial troops from North and especially West Africa, right? So racism certainly existed in France. But at the same time, the way that they approached race was certainly different than the way that the United States approached it. And they also had a much different set of priorities when it came to the war and their conceptions of military efficiency, right? They did not hesitate to use Black soldiers in the case of the early stages of the war, African soldiers on the front lines. And in the case of African-American soldiers, they didn't hesitate to throw them into the fray as well. Certainly didn't see them as equal to white soldiers, to Frenchmen, but they still saw them as capable and effective fighters, nevertheless.
Is there an element where you say then that we've got this difference in experiences between the 93rd and the 92nd? So guys under French command then, are they almost kind of free to prove themselves, free to fight appropriately? Whereas our other guys that are still part of the AEF are, you know, almost have that treatment as they are inferior, and therefore they're not really given anything important to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And again, W.E.B. Du Bois recognized this really from the start, you know, from the initial organization of the 92nd Division in the United States domestically. It essentially never had a fighting chance. The military in developing or organizing the 92nd Division actually split the division up into like four or five separate training camps before it even reached France. So it never had a chance to develop the sense of camaraderie and organizational cohesiveness that was necessary for an effective fighting division. Black officers were disparaged and maligned even before they arrived in France. So it never really had a chance to succeed from the start, right? This idea that the 92nd Division was a failure was almost kind of a preordained prophecy in many ways. Mm. And this is what W.B. Du Bois was trying to do in telling the history of the war, really trying to correct the racist misconceptions that emerged after the war in the historical telling, the historical record of the war that tried to occlude Black soldiers or disparage and malign them altogether. He was committed to telling the history in a way that was honest and reclaimed the contributions that these men had during the war, as well as their dignity.
Okay, so let's move on to Du Bois himself then. So your book, The Wounded World, covers Du Bois and the First World War. But who was he? What is his history and his work, and what impact did it actually have? Because we know we've talked about all the things he was trying to do. What impact does he actually have on World War One and the wider sphere?
Yeah, W.B. Du Bois is arguably the greatest Black intellectual in American history. He lived a remarkable life, 95 years. He was born in 1868, just a few years after the end of the Civil War. He dies in 1963 in Accra, Ghana, literally the day before the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in August of 1963. So 95 years, he was the first African-American to receive a PhD from Harvard University. He was a pioneering historian as well as sociologist, wrote 22 single-authored books along with literally hundreds of articles and editorials. He helped lay the foundation for the modern civil rights movement, was one of the co-founders of the NAACP. And at the time of the war, he was recognized as arguably the most important voice for African-Americans, right? He was one of the most important African-American leaders in the country. So when Du Bois comes out in support of the war and in support of the Allies, that is a major decision on his part. And African-Americans are following his lead. Du Bois believed that the war had the potential to expand the possibilities of democracy and citizenship for African-Americans. And that's ultimately why he supports the war, very controversially, encourages African-Americans, as he writes in an editorial entitled Close Ranks, to forget their special grievances and support their country 100%, put their country over race and civil rights. And he has to live with the controversy surrounding that decision and ultimately the disillusion that follows after the war when he realizes that the risks that he took in supporting the war were not going to materialize in any type of positive way.
So he's trying to sell this idea that, come on, sign up for this war because you go and do your bit. Like you say, put country before race, then the country might put country before race when you come back.
Right.
It's almost
right.
that like, it's that argument that suffragettes were making. It's just like, we'll support the First World War and you'll give us the vote. And
it makes that exact comparison, right? Right before, right after the United States enters the war in April 17, he writes an editorial saying that just like the British suffragettes, we're going to take the risk, take the gamble that if we support our country and do our patriotic part, our country will reward us in the end. So it's actually the exact comparison that Du Bois himself makes.
What does he achieve?
That's really one of the questions that I explore in my book, right? And my book is really the story of hope, Du Bois hoping for a positive outcome from the war, of him wrestling with the post-war disillusionment of those hopes not materializing, and then ultimately reckoning with the failure of the war and his own failure to write the history of the war. It's a really kind of tragic book in the end, because it speaks to the reality that in Du Bois's eyes, the war ultimately was indeed a failure, and that African Americans didn't get anything positive out of it, and the world didn't get anything positive out of it as well. He titles his book The Wounded World. The Black Man and the Wounded World, right? And I think he's asking really a remarkably poignant question. What does it mean to live in a wounded world? What does it mean to live in a world that's scarred, that's wounded by war and racism and white supremacy and empire and economic inequality, right? By the time World War II arrives, he's come to the tragic conclusion that World War I was a failure, and that the world remained quite possibly irreparably wounded.
Leading us nicely in then with mention of World War II there, we've got another question from one of our subscribers, Simon Clark. Simon asks, he says, I've seen suggested that World War II African-American service women and men were better treated by the British in terms of segregation. What were attitudes like in World War I across the various nations? How were they treated by the British, the French?
So, as I said, African-American soldiers, compared to how they were treated by their fellow white American soldiers, received a much better treatment by the French. In terms of their treatment by the British, sorry to say, the British were extremely racist in how they approached even the possibility of African-American soldiers serving with them. As a matter of fact, General Pershing offered the 92nd Division to the British military, and they refused. They didn't want anything to do with African-American troops, and so the 92nd Division remained in the American Expeditionary Forces. So British attitudes towards the use of Black soldiers, particularly combat soldiers, even their own colonial soldiers, was deeply racist. They believed that in terms of the fighting, it was indeed a white man's war. So their colonial troops were largely relegated to labor duties and in other theaters of war, certainly not on the Western Front.
Okay, well, the legacy of African-American participation in World War I is often overlooked. So in your view, A, why does that matter today, which I know might be an obvious, like the blue touch paper question, and what impact did their service actually have on the civil rights movement and the broader struggle for equality following the war?
So you have a number of African-American soldiers, after they come back from fighting in the war, are determined that things are going to be different. They've fought in this war. They've given their lives, risked their lives for their country. They traveled to France. They've seen other possibilities of race relations. They come back to the United States to racial hatred, racial violence, and what was known as the Red Summer of 1919. riots and lynchings erupted, many Black veterans being attacked, some lynched, still wearing their uniforms. So the war and the post-war period combined really changed the attitude, the minds, the consciousness of an entire generation of Black veterans who were determined that they are not going to settle for the status quo. So in ways small, subtle, but also large, they make a determination that they are going to fight for their rights. And it's that groundwork that they lay during the 1920s and 30s through organizations like the NAACP, through more radical organizations like the Universal Negro Improvement Association, right? Through other more creative means, whether it's in the realm of popular culture and the Harlem Renaissance during the 1920s and 30s, right? They really begin to change the way that African Americans are thinking about themselves, their place in the war, in the world, right? And their struggle for civil rights. And that begins to really bear fruit in the 1940s and certainly by the 1950s, right? We were talking about World War II. African Americans in World War II really learned the lessons from World War I, that they're not going to settle for just simply closing ranks, as Du Bois wrote about. They're going to fight for their rights both abroad and at home. The Double V campaign, fighting for victory abroad, fighting against racism at home. So really being very clear and explicit that if we are going to support our country, if we are going to fight and die for our country, we are going to demand our rights as well. And it's in that moment in the 1940s where you see the activism emerging, which gives rise to the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s.
So physically, you know, what are they doing to start that fight? What do they do? What does that campaign look like?
So you have soldiers as veterans who are founding their own organizations. They're participating in the American Legion, which was completely segregated, but they're establishing all Black American Legion divisions, also starting other organizations that are specifically for African-American veterans to fight for civil rights. They're joining national organizations like the NAACP, which Du Bois was involved in as editor of the Crisis magazine. They're founding new chapters all over the country, including in the Deep South. They're traveling abroad. Some veterans actually stay in France and are active in different organizations in that capacity. And then you have a number of individuals who become very active in different types of civil rights campaigns. So one individual who I always like to use as an example is Charles Hamilton Houston, who served as an officer in the war. He becomes active in the NAACP, uses his disillusionment to go to law school, receives his law degree from Harvard Law School, and really begins to lay the groundwork for dismantling Jim Crow segregation through legal means. The NAACP's legal campaign, which eventually leads to the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954. He's really the father of that campaign, the architect of that legal strategy. So you have men, you know, who are or more well known like Charles Hamilton Houston, but also, you know, untold numbers of men who in their own ways, you know, really remain active in the struggle for civil rights, both nationally as well as locally.
Okay, so whenever you talk about, you know, African American civil rights movement, you know, as a middle-aged white Englishman, I'm instantly going to be thinking of 1960s, you know, Martin Luther King.
Sure.
But,
sure.
You know, the obvious. But this is, there's actually, without this, without Du Bois, you know, King would have twice the battle that he had. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. W.B. Du Bois, as I said earlier, was really the grandfather of the modern civil rights movement as we know it today. He was active, involved in pretty much every major issue facing African Americans and other peoples of African descent throughout the globe from the late 19th century, really up until his death in 1963. And Martin Luther King Jr., in fact, recognized the importance of Du Bois to the struggle for civil rights, but also recognized him as a historian as well, as a historian who was committed to telling the truth and to challenging racist misconceptions and myths of American history.
Would you like to cover a few of those racist misconceptions and myths that were around at the time then, the sort of things that Du Bois is challenging?
Right. So first, this idea that Black men could not be effective soldiers and officers. Right. This was something that infuriated Du Bois.
Yeah.
That sparked his own rage, right? He had a deep appreciation and reverence for the Black military tradition. His great-great-grandfather actually served in the American Revolution. His father briefly served in the Civil War in the Union Army. One of his heroes was Frederick Douglass, who famously encouraged African-Americans to join the Union Army during the Civil War. So he was very much aware of the historical contributions of African-Americans as soldiers and as officers in American military history, but also linking it to a broader struggle for Black freedom and citizenship and civil rights. That's only one of the reasons why he believed so deeply that World War I was going to be a transformative moment, that it was going to be kind of akin to the Civil War, right, in giving African Americans expanded freedom and rights. All right, so he was adamant that distortion of history had to be addressed.
Yeah, it must have been absolutely crippling as well, coming into that aftermath where none of this actually really happens, that fight still has to continue. Because as you say, you're using the Civil War as your benchmark, which, yeah, it doesn't deliver the sort of citizenship that they're looking for, but it is an absolute major change.
Absolutely.
In the life of most African Americans in the population at the time. And it can't be much of an ask to have another major change following another major war. And it doesn't happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is why Du Bois's reckoning with the war was so powerful on an intellectual level. I mean, Du Bois was the consummate intellectual. He was always thinking and writing. That's how he dealt with the issues of the times. Right. But it was also deeply personal for him. He put his credibility on the line. Du Bois considered himself a pacifist. But he made the decision that fighting for their country was going to be worth it, that African Americans fighting for their country was ultimately going to be worth it. And supporting this war, in spite of his pacifist beliefs, was ultimately going to be worth it. And he was wrong. And he had to reckon with the weight of that decision and the failure of that decision really throughout his entire life, throughout the interwar period and in the aftermath of World War II. And it was such an important moment for him in terms of his political evolution. How we can't think of Du Bois in terms of the evolution of his politics, how he becomes, by the 1950s, a radical peace activist without understanding how that evolution took place and how it was connected to him reckoning with the disillusionment and failure of World War I.
Okay, so in recent years, there's been a much welcome growing interest in uncovering and preserving the history of African-American involvement in World War I, World War II, Vietnam, etc. So what steps can be taken to ensure that this history is accurately documented and shared with future generations? How would you like to see that work?
Yeah, well, I think certainly recognizing the work that historians like myself are doing, by my book, to learn more about this history, right? I think it's just so critical that we educate ourselves, that we educate the broader public about just the basic facts Black contributions to the war, right? And then I think also just trying to tell the stories that are a part of the war, right? I mean, that's really what I try and do in my book. I mean, there's so many really remarkable stories and individuals that are connected to Du Bois and his own really quite remarkable story. You know, I think that we just need to make sure that we're highlighting those voices, that we're seeking them out and providing the opportunities for those voices and for those stories to come to the surface to be told.
Well, would you then, to close off, to give us all something to think about, would you give us you know, one of the stories, one of the individuals that features in the book. It's a teaser for them to go and get the rest.
Sure. So one of the people that, you know, I love writing about is Colonel Charles Young. Colonel Charles Young was the highest ranking black officer in the military, in the American military, at the start of the war. He was also one of W.E.B. Du Bois's closest friends. They met at Wilberforce College at the beginning of Du Bois's career. If you think of Colin Powell, Colonel Charles Young was Colin Powell before there was Colin Powell. He had that type of stature, right? He was that important. He was such a powerful symbol for the possibility of African-Americans embracing their country, but also supporting and fighting for their race, right? And he had the opportunity to become a general in the war, but the army prematurely retired him for dubious health reasons. It was a travesty. And Du Bois was incensed. African-Americans across the country were heartbroken. He's ultimately reinstated very conveniently at the end of the war. And he serves in West Africa, where he very tragically dies in 1923. His story, I think, is incredibly gripping, very tragic, but also very emblematic of the challenges that African-Americans and African-American soldiers and officers had to face, but also the challenges that Du Bois himself had to face, how the war certainly was a historical challenge, but it was also a deeply personal challenge for him as well.
Well, thank you very much for that, Chad, because like I said to you at the start, I came into this knowing absolutely nothing. First World War is not my area of expertise at all, but that has been an absolute eye-opener. And it's encouraged me to go off and look at this further, so I shall start by buying your excellent book.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Do you feel better for having got that off your chest then?
I do. Yeah, my shoulders feel a little bit lighter now.
Good. Good. Well, if you'd like to know more about this subject, then you can and should read Chad's range of books covering African Americans and the Great War. We're going to have links to all of those in the show notes. And you can follow him on Twitter at Dr_ChadWilliams. But once again, Chad, thank you very much for coming to History Rage.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. We would really appreciate any reviews you could leave with us on Apple, Podchaser, or Amazon. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage, or individually, I am at Paul Bavel, and Kyle is at Kyle G History. And if you're loving this, then please support us on Patreon. In return for your cherished £5 per month, we will give you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, the invite to book questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until next week, from all of us here, stay angry. Bye-bye.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.